1, 2, 3.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's just some of the best of blues man Joe Bonamassa so far. Just in case you've been away since the beginning of the 21st century, like maybe on an interplanetary mission to Mars, let me fill you in on the dizzying career of American guitarist, singer, songwriter Joe Bonamassa, on a Guinness Book record-setting pace since his debut album in 2000. At the tender age of only 20, Bonamassa has toured tirelessly, resulting in no less than 6 live albums and an equal number of DVDs, including 2013's An Acoustic Evening at the Vienna Opera House and the massive Tour de Force Live in London 4 DVD set. These live filmed concerts in particular, starting with 2009's Live from Royal Albert Hall, have placed Bonamassa repeatedly on PBS television stations and into the mainstream unlike anyone since Stevie Ray Vaughan's death in 1990. The stage of the Vienna Opera House is a long way from where Joe Bonamassa was a boy in upstate New York.
It is. It's like, it's very rural. You know, New York itself, you know, when you think, like you say, when you think New York, you think, you know, the Big Apple, Empire State Building. But where I grew up was a town of like 30,000 people, mostly a farming, you know, town. And basically, you know, us guitar players up there, because it rains a lot, it's almost like Seattle. And it rains a lot and it's super cold in the winter. So, you know, us musicians have nothing better to do than to stay in their rooms and practice. So that's why I think there's been some like really great players that have come out of, you know, upstate New York, because basically, you know, we have nothing better to do than to sit, you know, in our rooms and practice. So that's what it's like. And my parents still live up there, and it's great to go back every once in a while. Well, I mean, singing wise, you got Lou Gramm, who came from Rochester. You have Steve Gadd, who plays, you know, one of the world's best drummers, who still lives in, you know, in that area. Kim Simmons from Savoy Brown. Yeah, there's just a bunch. You'd be surprised. Basically, you know, Orion the Hunter, you know, famous band in the early 80s. Elf, which had Ronnie James Dio, came out of that area. So it's just, you know, it's just kind of a, you know, interesting, you know, hidden little secret that a lot of these guys were born there and kind of raised within this like 150-mile radius. I grew up in a valley, so it looks, you know, it looks typically like Wisconsin, or you know if you go into Germany, it kind of looks a lot like Germany. I think that's why a lot of, you know, the European immigrants settled there. And you know, I mean, it's been around for, you know, a long time. I mean, it's like there was the history of it. It was, you know, a main battleground, you know, for the Revolutionary War, and a lot of that, you know, that stuff was, you know, it's still preserved, and you know, you have the old forts and stuff like that, and a lot of American history, you know, basically was written, and a lot of the you know, a lot of the historical, you know, scenarios went down there. It used to be manufacturing, and the Cold War pretty much, you know, was when it really peaked. It was a lot of military manufacturing, General Electric, you know, Lockheed Martin, you know, and there was a lot of blue-collar workers, you know, like my dad and stuff like that worked in a factory and, you know, warehouses and stuff like that. And basically around 1990, you know, the military, you know, the Air Force base closed, and it was pretty much the beginning of the end. And now it's like my town that at one point in time, I think in the early 90s, had 125,000 people living, it has like 27,000. I mean, it just decimated the area. And it was very strange to go back and see all these buildings and businesses and stuff that you grew up looking at just closed and completely out of business. And there's not a lot of young people that are still staying there. And it's really kind of sad. And but if you walk into Flint, Michigan, if you walk into, you know, anywhere, you know, kind of north of the Mason-Dixon line with that same scenario that they were manufacturing-based jobs, blue-collar workers, you know, you see it, you know, basically all over the country, and it's just kind of sad because it's like these little towns that sustain themselves and, you know, just with, you know, with these communities and, you know, with generations living in them, have been just kind of destroyed.
Oh,
Irony of the song title Never Make Your Move Too Soon, coming from a 24-year-old on his fourth album, is certainly not lost on Joe Bonamassa, whose father was a musician who taught Joe well.
Well, yeah, he would, you know, he played local gigs, and you know, he had a family to support. He didn't want to tour, and he didn't want to, like, you know, take it beyond where it was. You know, I'm a fourth generation musician. My great grandfather actually played a little bit with Glenn Miller for, you know, a brief period, you know, back in the late 30s or something like that. And, you know, he was a trumpet player, and my grandfather was a trumpet player. And my dad, being a product of the late 60s and complete rebellion against all things, you know, traditional, and, you know, he basically didn't want to play jazz, wanted to play, you know, Leslie West and, you know, Mountain, you know. So that was, you know, that's kind of like what he, you know, what he was into. And I kind of followed halfway in between that. So, I started playing guitar when I was four. And I started playing classical music right off the bat. And by the time I was eight, I decided that I didn't really like the classical, you know, discipline, where I couldn't, you know, I couldn't interpret anything on my own, and I couldn't basically play it the way I wanted to play it, you know. And I had to, you know, adhere to these 200, 300-year-old traditions, which, you know, I just wasn't into. So not to say it's bad, but it was just me. Then I heard the blues. I heard, like, Eric Clapton, and I heard, you know, ZZ Top, and then I heard basically a lot of the English guys, you know, Free, and, you know, with Paul Rodgers and you know, Zeppelin and all those guys doing blues. And that kind of sparked my interest in, you know, listening to, like, Robert Johnson and, you know, I mean, a lot of the, you know, just, you know, guitar heroes. I mean, even, like, Guitar Slim and Muddy Waters and all that. So Freddie King was another one too. So it was like, that's kind of how I cut my teeth on getting into the blues. And by the time I was eight or nine, I was, you know, playing and sitting in with my dad's band and going around to blues festivals and, you know, sitting in. As I was like the little, you know, little white kid that would show up to these blues festivals with a guitar, you know.
But how in the world did this untried, untested 20-year-old at the time get late legendary producer Tom Dowd to work with Joe?
My A&R guy at Epic Records basically said, hey, would you like to make a record with Tom Dowd? I was like, yeah, I'd love to make a record with Tom Dowd. And I just thought, I mean, like, everybody says stuff and not a lot of it comes true sometimes. And he's like, you know, he wants, you know, I know Tom and I've worked with Tom a bunch. And, you know, he'd like, because, you know, Michael also signed the Allman Brothers to Epic at that time. And so it was like, he knew Tom. And Tom, you know, still worked up until the day he died. Basically, it was, you know, a thing where he came up and saw a gig that I did. And he really liked it, and he and I just hit it off, you know. And what a brilliant man, and what a brilliant, you know, such a nice person too. And it's like you know, you could learn so much just by being around him on how to be a good person, and you know, and live your life. You know, I mean, he was a true Renaissance man. I mean, here's a guy who produced, you know, and engineered, I mean, records that you can't even quantify their you know, position in rock and roll history, and also worked on the Manhattan Project as well, you know. And it's like it. To me, but he never wore any of that on his shoulder, and it was just very much a very simple thing for me, which is like, you know, I'm Tom, and I make records, and, you know, I just happened to make Disraeli Gears, and, you know, and all these great, you know, recordings, and Otis Redding, and this and that, but he never, unless you asked him about it, he never would, you know, he never would say. He made the record for me that I had to make, you know, and it wasn't like, he didn't put his Layla, you know, production on that. It was the record that I was going to make regardless, and he just helped me get to that point.
One of these days, boy, I'm gonna see my one. I'm gonna see my children. The children on their knee. Gonna run up to my woman and hold her in my arms. With tears in her eyes, she says, I'm glad you're free. She's coming down the road, boy. I said she's coming down the road. She's got a red dress on. Yeah, she's got a red dress on. She's coming down the road, boy, with her bag down low. Says she's coming down the road, boy. She's got her bags down low. You're coming home, home. One of these days, boy, I've been coming home, home. One of these days, boy, I'm gonna see my baby. I'm gonna see my baby. I'm coming down the road. Gonna have my pardon. Pardon in her apron. Oh, wanna see the governor. She said, release my man. I'll be coming home, home. I'll be coming down the road, boy, with my bag down low. One of these days, boy, I'll be coming home, home.
Still to come, the anvil on which future blues is shaped gets a pounding from a ball-peen hammer. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find a whole lot more here at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, you're in the studio with the best of Joe Bonamassa. Joe Bonamassa didn't want to be just a six-string sideman, but the total package, like his heroes, and that meant developing a strong, mature singing voice that this powerful music demanded. Joe credits veteran rock producer Kevin Shirley with helping Bonamassa summon the soul.
To me, it's like I knew that, you know, as a singer, I wasn't as good a singer as I could have been, you know, and I knew that I had to work on singing. I knew I had to work on the writing, and I knew I had to work on a lot of the stuff coming out of that album. But the way the album's been judged, and you know, the pressure that I have, you know, every time I go to make a record is try to make it better than, you know, everything that I've ever done without repeating myself. I finally, as a singer, feel more confident in myself, and I think Kevin has helped bring that out of me. And so I feel I can carry a song, you know, without an 80 bar, you know, epic guitar solo, you know, and I think that's, you know, that was something that I had to get out of my head, that every song needed like this epic, you know, solo to save, you know, to take, you know, kind of take attention away from the bad singing, I thought. But it was, you know, it was definitely, you know, a lot of pressure, and it's still a lot of pressure to this day, because it's like expectations now are so much higher. Going, well, we loved You and Me, and we loved, you know, A New Day Yesterday, and we loved, you know, the Blues Deluxe series thing I did, and we pre-ordered your record, and Don't Let Us Down. Like, oh, no pressure at all. Not at all. Here, or let me just. That's why I always carry $18.97 in my pocket. Anybody complains, here, here's your money back. Yeah.
One of Bonamassa's strengths is his choice of outside material to play, often mixing a handful of his best compositions with strong but lesser-known songs by a wide variety of blues rock veterans.
Sequencing is so important on a record, because if you don't have a good sequence, you know, I might just lob the tracks on there. It doesn't hit the listener the right way. It's like a bad set list at a show. If you do four ballads in the set and you open up with your four ballads, it's people going, wow, it's just kind of dying on the vine. It's so very important. There's so many little tweaks that, you know, just the space in between the songs, you know, on the CD, you know, you go back and forth with the mastering guy going, no, that's too big a space. We have, you know, let's tighten that up. And it's why I do one record every 18 months, because it's too nerve-wracking. I have to take too many Zantac to get through these things.
Someone gonna mistreat you. You've been laughing, pretty babe. Someday you're gonna be crying. You've been laughing, pretty babe. Someday soon you're gonna be crying. Up the road, you'll find out I'm running line.
Yeah, buddy, from the 2009 Royal Albert Hall with Eric Clapton and Joe Bonamassa.
That was the coolest thing I've ever done.
That kind of endorsement, the EC seal of approval, is the most coveted in all of rock and blues. And the last time it was so publicly done would have been when Clapton embraced the late Stevie Ray Vaughan. Joe Bonamassa discussed Vaughan's abilities.
I think Stevie's gift was he was able to communicate with, again, it's just being able to, there's a lot of great guitar players, and there's arguably a gazillion that have come before and have come since. But Stevie's legacy, I think, really is he was the guy who could put on a guitar, any guitar, play three notes, and have people instantly hooked and going, something really cool is going on here. And that you can't teach. That was that's a inherent, talent that he had. He also had the ability to select songs that also communicated with people, and also not only communicated with straight blues fans, but people who weren't outside the blues. They're going, I didn't know this was the blues, and I love it, And having that ability to kind of like cross the line and bring everybody into the fold was really, I think, his most lasting legacy. And arguably there are more copiers of Stevie Ray than there are of Hendrix. And I mean, to have that legacy is just, I mean, an awesome accomplishment. And it's just because everybody knows they can go out for $300 and buy a Stratocaster and an amp and have it sound, reasonably like Stevie Ray Vaughan if they choose to. Not to diminish his skill on a guitar, but it was like he's everybody's guitar player.
Around 2007, Joe Bonamassa's career started to gain some traction, particularly in the UK, where the young American, still not 30, was appearing at several summer festivals smack dab in the middle of many of his idols.
We were doing these festivals, these mixed festivals. We would be put on, like, this summer we were put on a festival with Steely Dan. I'm like, oh, great, we're playing with Steely Dan. Well, nobody happened to mention that Steely Dan was playing before us. And then, Larry Carlton and Robin Ford were playing after. And I'm like sandwiched in between all these bands, and it would happen, the same deal with Joe Cocker, same deal with like a bunch of these other bands. And I was like going, how am I supposed to go up against all this, these great songs and these hits and even wildly compete when I don't really have a discernible hit song? I mean, there's some stuff that they know from me, but nothing that really quantifies the hit. I was like, I need to get some songs with more melody in it. I need to get some songs, not songs that are pandering to any kind of like, bass where, I'm just trying to sell out and sell a bunch of records. It was just, listening to stuff that actually, means something to people, but also has something you can sing along with. You can't sing along with like a 30 bar guitar solo. So, unless it's like Layla, and you can count those on one hand, So to me, it's like, that's what kind of the vision was for Slow Gin, was like, to have songs that when people, when you started the song, people clapped and go, oh, I love that song. I didn't know he did that, and just kind of like trying to find the best, melodies and the best, just writing, whether I did it or somebody else did it,
Besides Stevie Ray Vaughan, another great loss to 21st century blues was the passing of Chris Whitley. Joe Bonamassa witnessed Whitley's brilliance nightly.
I had the honor of opening up for Chris back in, I think, 2000. And me and my little three-piece band in a van, in trailer, and his crew in a van, in trailer. And I would set up my three-piece band, play, and we'd do pretty good. And then he'd walk up there with a dobro and a microphone and just crush me. I was just like, man, he's really good. And his writing, his lyrics always got to me in, like a fundamental way, because he's just really soulful and, never pandered to that kind of coffee house singer-songwriter crowd. We're trying to be intelligent and trying to, like, show people that you read T.S. Eliot. It's like exactly what I'm talking about, because people get very heady about that. And he was a great lyricist and just an absolutely crushing guitar player. On dobro and slide and everything. And So he gave me one of his records that he recorded like in Vermont. And one of the tracks on there, like Baron, was this ball peen hammer that done solo acoustic. And I always heard it as this like epic kind of Zeppelin-y kind of thing. But I never got around to doing it. And finally, with Slow Jam, we said, like, let's give it a whirl. And, you know, and Kevin said, let's put some strings on it. And then let's put some, you know, it was supposed to be just a straight acoustic version. And then let's put some strings on it. Oh, well, now that we're here, let's put some electrics on it. And then let's double the electrics. And then, oh, let's put this slide solo on there. And all of a sudden we had this monstrous track. And we're going, wow, it actually came out really good.
I'm going to go there. I'm going to climb. Now I don't know about no law. I don't see no crime. Ain't no reason, ain't no rest. I'm gonna get down to the wall and get undressed. I can stand it, I can stand it. I can't wait to see them walls fall down. You tell me, Jesus, why they run. Is it by the weight of the woman, weight of the gun? Got 15 minutes now, and I just don't care. I'm gonna take this all for granted when I get there. And I can stand it, I can stand it. I can't wait to see them walls falling down. And I can stand it, I can stand it. I can't wait to see them walls fall down. Tomorrow, a Sunday rhyme. You know all good things come in their due time. Put the ball-peen hammer right through that door. And I don't pretend to understand no more. I can stand it, I can stand it. I can't wait to see them walls falling down. I can stand it, I can stand it. I can't wait to see them walls falling down.
Chris Whitley's Ball Peen Hammer, given the full When the Levee Breaks Led Zeppelin treatment by Joe Bonamassa, with Paul Schaefer TV band drummer Anton Figg doing a spot-on John Bonham sound. Here's Joe Bonamassa.
Like, we found this Chris Whitley song, you know, Ball Peen Hammer, which I thought to me was perfect for me, and it kind of signifies everything that I wanted to try to do at Slow Gin. And then Kevin brought Slow Gin to the table, which I think is just, you know, one of my biggest songs ever. And I just think the recording of it came out really good too. So that's kind of what we were going after, and we're just trying to go after, you know, not repeating yourself approach, you know, and not making You and Me Part Two, and not, you know, there was a lot of like, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do that, but we want to make this good. We had a huge amount of, you know, like an orchestra, you know, strings come in and do that, And I just love the way it sounded. To me, it just kind of made it more sophisticated and a little bit different, you know? And it kind of took some of the edge off of just being straight blues. I just didn't want to see that song Slow Jen end up, like, the vibe of it didn't need to be in, like, a smoky bar. It had to be in, like a performing arts center where people had to dress up in a collared shirt, you know?
Slow Jen, Slow Jen, trying to wash away the pain. Well, I'm sick and I'm all done in, and I'm standing in the rain, and I feel like I'm gonna cry. I'm so damn lonely and I ain't even high. I'm so damn lonely and I feel like I'm gonna die. Mayday, mayday, I've been shot down over stormy sea.
what a great epic performance. 2007 title song to Joe Bonamassa's Slow Gin album.
People actually really do it. They either think the strings are, they either love them or hate them, but I think they're beautiful because it adds such a nice bass to solo on, and it's such an emotional payoff, and because basically it just adds the soulfulness to it. It's like the old Ray Charles thing, you know, and that's been kind of the thing for me. It's like if you have this kind of soulful approach to it, you know, I think the song is just, you know, and it's just a song. It's a song. It's there's no rule book. I mean, I still work on the vocal, and the vocal to me is and kind of like in Stevie Ray Vaughan's case, it's like I think the more you do it, the better you get at it. And, you know, and I still take vocal lessons. Yeah, and it's like for me, it's like being able to go out and play 175 gigs a year has given me this advantage to going. I'd sing, you know, at least 175 days a year, if not more, you know, and that's just, you know, that kind of practice and that kind of experience on a stage is such a you know, a real advantage. Developing your voice, you know, it's also taking care of yourself, and it's also like we were talking about, like Stevie Ray Vaughan's voice rapidly improved, you know, when he became clean and sober, because, you know, it's a very physical thing. You know, if I have the flu or strep throat or something like that, and somebody gives me a guitar, I can still play. You know, my hands are not broken. You know, but if I have the flu or a cold or something like that, and there's definitely a tremendous impact on the singing voice, and it's just a lot of physical stuff there. And so for me, it's like that's one of those things where, you know, I think Stevie's, you know, legacy and again, they don't really give him enough credit for it. Singing, and I don't think if you asked him today, he probably wouldn't give himself a whole lot of credit for his singing. But, you know, the public judges that. And, you know, his voice, I always thought was really, really good and interesting. You know, I mean, even like, you know, Cold Shot and some of the stuff on the early records, very soulful, interesting voice that, you know, didn't sound like anybody, and nobody's ever sounded like him since.
With NFL football playoff season upon us and heading toward the Super Bowl, I had to ask if the upstate New York native had a favorite.
Don't like the Buffalo Bills. I like the New York Giants. That's how I was raised. We root against the Bills. So I just don't like. I'm not buying what the Bills are selling. You know, I'm a New York Giant fan because it's like, it's a proximity effect to Albany. You know, if you're less than 100 miles from Albany, which we are, when I grew up, it was 93 miles from Albany. You must like New York Yankees baseball and New York Giants football. If you're over 100 miles, then you can like the Mets. You know, that's, you know, gluttons for punishment, Jets or the Bills. Everything else is uncivilized. So, not that we were never big Cowboy fans, being NFC people. Either, because that was like our arch rival. But now that Parcells went down there, and he's not even coaching anymore. But it's, you know, we have a lot of strong ties to Dallas. I actually love the town, so I that's why I wear black nondescript hats. I neither friend or foe of any of the local sports people.
Seagull, you fly across the horizon into the misty morning sun. Nobody asked you where you are going. Nobody knows where you're from. There is a man asking the question, is it really the end of the world? Seagull, you must have known for a long time the shapes of things to come. Now you Seagull, you fly across the horizon into the misty morning sun. Nobody asked you where you are going. Nobody knows where.
you'll find.